Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. Our world has been hot this year. This June was the warmest on record, and four of the six warmest months in recorded history have recurred this year. I think the last 15 years have been the last hottest years in the last since the weather's been recorded too, and the National Oceanic and Atmosphere Administration reports that there's no evidence of a long-term slowdown for global warming. That is, unless we change our ways. And today I'm speaking with three people who are bringing this struggle to the courts throughout the U.S. and in countries around the world. It's called Our Children's Trust, and they are arguing that the atmosphere belongs to all of us as a public trust. I have on the phone Julia Olson, Executive Director of Our Children's Trust. You're on the phone there, Julia, right?
I am.
Great.
Hello, Stephanie.
And Kelsey Giuliana, who has a lawsuit going here in Oregon. Kelsey, you're on the phone too?
Yes, I am.
Beautiful. And we have Chris Winner here. He's of the Craig Law Center. He's an attorney working with Kelsey, and he's here with me in the studio.
Good morning, Stephanie.
Hi. Okay. So I'd like to start, actually, with a big win that our Children's Trust just had in Washington. And could we just talk about what happened there, Julia.
Yeah, sure, no problem. So, yeah, there was this really great decision by Judge Hollis Hill in Washington in King County. And she basically was responding to a lawsuit filed by eight young people in Washington State. And they were challenging the Department of Ecology's denial of a petition that they made asking the agency that's responsible for greenhouse gas emissions to set their reductions and a plan for their reductions based on the best science of returning atmospheric CO2 levels to a safe level of 350 parts per million and doing their part. And the agency had rejected the kids' petition, and they took it to court, and they argued that they had constitutional rights, they had rights as public trust beneficiaries, and that the agency had violated the law. And the judge remanded the decision back to the agency and said, look, you didn't consider the best science that's been presented to you, and you've said that there's significant catastrophic changes occurring, and you need to take one more look at this and come back and report to me and tell me if you're going to actually do the rulemaking that the youth have asked you to do. So that process is underway right now, and next week the youth are actually going to meet with the Department of Ecology and have some settlement discussions to see if they can resolve the issue before it goes back to the court.
And this is actually an unprecedented decision. I mean, what exactly is groundbreaking about it? Why is it so important?
It's the first time that a court has said to government that they need to actually consider the best available science on climate change, and specifically the judge ordered them to consider the science of Dr. James Hansen, who he and his colleagues have been saying for years that 350 parts per million of CO2 is the maximum level we should have in the atmosphere, and right now we're over 400.
Right.
And so it's that part of the case is really unprecedented.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And let's talk a little then about what's going on here in Oregon. Kelsey, I'm sorry about your name. Kelsey Giuliana, yeah. So you're part of this lawsuit, right? Kelsey, what are you mm-hmm. trying to accomplish?
Right, well, I'm a co-plaintiff along with another youth in Oregon, and we're trying to bring forth a Climate Recovery Act to reduce carbon emissions statewide by 6%, which is what top climate scientists have prescribed as the level we need to get our CO2 emissions down to ensure a stable climate and therefore survivability of future generations. And so we're, kind of using all three branches of government here and kind of framing this as bringing our constitutional rights into play and protecting vital natural resources, not only for this generation, but so that future generations, seven generations down the line, may have access to these resources needed for survival. So it's groundbreaking, but it's also looking back at constitutional rights that every person should have inevitable access to.
And down by 6%. So is this something that is being considered? Like you apparently brought this lawsuit to court and it was rejected. And why was that the first time? This was like a year ago?
Well, we first brought this case when I was 15. I'm now 19, turning 20. So it's been a process. And we first brought it to Judge Rasmussen, and he dismissed it, basically stating that it wasn't in his jurisdiction to rule on this case. So then we appealed, brought it to the Court of Appeals. It sat in front of a 3-judge panel. This would be 2 years later. And they dismissed Judge Rasmussen's dismissal. Uh-huh. And they said that, no, actually, this is an important case, and you do have jurisdiction to rule on this. And so then just this year, in April, I went back to the courtroom, and we sat in front of Judge Rasmussen for the second time, and he, again, dismissed the case, stating that the atmosphere does not apply as a resource needed for protection under the public trust doctrine, and also arguing that other resources such as submerged and submersible lands, wildlife, they also do not apply under the public trust doctrine. But the thing is, these resources have already been accepted and protected under this piece of law. So not only did he refuse to state what we were asking, the atmosphere to be protected, but also he argued against what has already been accepted and protected. So, yep.
And Chris, maybe you could add, you have another appeal going, and what's that about?
Right. So Judge Rasmussen's most recent decision came down, I believe it was in April earlier this year, following an argument down in Lane County Circuit Court. That argument was on the merits of the public trust doctrine, as Kelsey was very articulately describing, whether the atmosphere is protected as a public trust resource and whether the state government has a fiduciary obligation to protect the integrity of that resource for current and future generations. So basically, do the youth have a fundamental right to clean air and clean water? And can they call on their state government to uphold those rights? Judge Rasmussen issued a decision which really undermined the public trust doctrine and basically left it up to the discretion of the state government as to whether to do anything at all about climate change and the really tremendous threats that it poses to our natural resources. And so that was a result of a very long legal process, but there's still more yet to go. And so we recently filed an appeal of his decision in the Oregon Court of Appeals, and we'll be preparing our legal briefs on that over the next several months. And so that's the next step in the process. And that will result eventually in an oral argument, probably down in Salem, in front of a 3-judge panel of the Court of Appeals. And that, again, will be on the merits of, you know, what does a public trust doctrine really provide? And do Kelsey and Olivia and the youth of today and tomorrow really have any fundamental rights to clean air and clean water here in the state?
And I've read that the whole idea of a public trust doctrine, it's hasn't really been applied to the atmosphere until you guys came along much, right?
Well, it hasn't been applied to the atmosphere in Oregon until this case. So this is a question, a first impression for the courts here in Oregon. But the public trust doctrine has been applied to other natural resources in Oregon, including our shorelands and tidelands, surface water, and wildlife. And basically what the courts have stated in those other contexts is that these essential natural resources, one, are critical to what we know and have come to expect as essential Oregon natural resources. Those are really key things we love and hold dear about Oregon, but also that the state government really has a fiduciary obligation to uphold those natural resources in benefit for the public as beneficiaries of a trust. And it's really the same concept as any other trust relationship under our legal system. So sometimes, you know, it's a financial instrument where a trustee has an obligation to manage a piece of property or some financial assets in benefit for somebody else. It's that same exact concept that has been articulated under the public trust doctrine in Oregon for a long time.
And Juliana, I mean, Kelsey or Julia, you could answer this. By its own admission, I read that the state of Oregon is actually failing to meet its carbon emission reduction goals. So is part of what your lawsuit is about is to demand that they start meeting those?
Yeah, this is Julia, and I'll jump in on that one. The state has made a lot of admissions, including the fact that even its non-binding goals that it set several years ago, it's off track to meet those. And if you look at our overall emissions in Oregon, including our consumption emissions, our emissions are growing. And so they're not meeting their duty. And on top of that, they don't dispute the science. They don't dispute the impacts that are occurring as a result of climate change and as a result of ocean acidification, which is another consequence of having too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
So it sounds like this appeal might work. And I read also that you had another win in New Mexico and through the Oregon Children's Trust. Could you tell us what happened there?
Sure. So there have been courts already in the last couple of years recognizing that the atmosphere is part of the public trust doctrine and should be protected by sovereign governments. So one of the first courts to make that ruling was a court in Texas. And the judge there said that Texas, under its constitution and under the common law public trust doctrine, has an obligation to protect the atmosphere. And then more recently, the New Mexico Court of Appeals also held that under the state constitution, the state must protect the atmosphere as a public trust resource for present and future generations. And there have been other courts judges in Iowa, in Alaska, in Arizona, as examples that have, well, not made that specific ruling. They have said or implied that, of course, the atmosphere is part of the public trust doctrine. So there's actually a lot of legal precedent being established through the campaign that Our Children's Trust is bringing. But also, if you look back to the origins of the public trust doctrine, air is the very first resource that's mentioned. It's air, waters, the sea, and the shores of the sea. And air is just part of our climate system. It affects our water quality and the amounts of fresh water we have. It's just critical to human life. So I think it's pretty impossible for anyone looking at science and facts to dispute that the atmosphere is a resource that must be protected if we want to have human civilization on this planet.
Right. And it sounds like then that you do have these actions going, not in all 50 states, but close to that. Is that really the case?
In 2011, when we launched the campaign and did this for young people around the country, we did have actions in all 50 states. Many of those were rulemaking petitions to administrative bodies. Since then, there have been a total of approximately 17 lawsuits.
Wow.
In court, and many of those have been dismissed, but there are many still proceeding. I think we have 5 or 6 active cases right now.
Uh-huh.
And more in the works.
More in the works, and even like actions going around the world. That was pretty impressive, too.
That's right. We have some amazing partners, including the fabulous attorneys and the organization Urgenda in the Netherlands, who just had another landmark win in their court, where the Dutch court said that the government was liable for acting on behalf of its people to stop climate change, and that they had a duty of care to protect not just the present generation, but future generations of Dutch people. So it's a very similar concept as the public trust doctrine here in the United States.
Yeah, and I do want to get into how this is definitely for future generations. I mean, it's Kelsey, that's basically why you're part of this. You know, you are going to be living with the consequences of climate change a lot longer than I will, and maybe we could get a little bit more into the science of climate change and what the scientists say that we really, really need to do. You were saying that we need to get to 350 parts per million, but exactly why is that?
Chris, you actually explained that really well to Judge Rasmussen. Do you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, thanks, Julia. Yeah, Judge Rasmussen had the same question in our hearing before Lane County Circuit Court in Eugene, and he really posed a question, well, what is this 350 parts per million, and why would I, as a judge here in Lane County, declare that to be the law? And what we know from Dr. Hansen's scientific work and the work of his team is basically that 350 parts per million, the atmosphere, which is constantly bombarded by heat from the sun, energy, the atmosphere at 350 parts per million is in an equilibrium state. Basically, it's absorbing as much energy as it is reflecting back into space. So if the concentrations of CO2 are more than 350 parts per million, the Earth absorbs more energy than it reflects. And over time, what happens is we get a continual warming of the atmosphere. And so at 350 parts per million, it's a state of equilibrium. The energy absorbed is approximately equivalent to the energy reflected. And at that point, we have the stable conditions within the atmosphere in which human society evolved.
Right.
And so right now we're at 400, 400 plus. And so that's why we're starting to see in very tangible ways changes, severe weather patterns changing, drought, fire, ocean acidification, sea level rise. Those are all the things that start to unravel once the atmosphere is out of a stage of equilibrium.
And it almost sounds like we need to get back to less than 350 for a while just to get ourselves back on where we were.
Right. Well, so what Dr. Hansen and his team of scientists have done is basically prescribed what they call a glide path back to 350 by the end of the century, which requires reductions in the amount of greenhouse gas emissions, because CO2 also degrades in the atmosphere over time.
Uh-huh.
And so their glide path is based on, you know, a number of calculations that basically take into account the rate of degradation of CO2 in the atmosphere and the rate of emissions, so that we reduce atmospheric concentration back to 350 by the end of the century. And that's going to require, as Kelsey stated earlier, approximately 6% annual reductions. If we start soon, and the longer we wait, the more severe those reductions have to be in order to get us back to where we need to be. And so it's essential that we take action quickly.
Quickly, quickly, quickly.
Yeah.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland. This is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. I'm speaking with some folks who are part of our Children's Trust. On the phone, Julia Olson, Executive Director of our Children's Trust, and Kelsey Juliana, who has a lawsuit going here in Oregon. Chris Winner of the Craig Law Center is an attorney working with Kelsey. He's here with me in the studio. And you can call in with your questions or comments. The number is 503-231-8187. And so I'd like to talk a little more about our Children's Trust. How did this get started?
Oh, gosh. We founded the organization in 2010 primarily to fill a void in the litigation that was happening around climate change and to meet the needs of youth who were advocating for climate action by their governments. And the void that we saw was there were a lot of lawsuits being filed and a lot of actions being taken to try to address specific causes of emissions, so power plants and coal mining and trying to get EPA to regulate carbon dioxide emissions. But we didn't have any litigation that was really addressing the bigger questions of our constitutional rights and forcing government to have a comprehensive plan that includes all of the different actions that need to be taken to stabilize our climate system and return the atmosphere to that energy balance state that Chris was describing. And so we partnered with some youth organizations and who really wanted to get involved in doing more than marching and writing letters and the movement building that is so important that they were already doing. And we helped connect these young people and organizations to lawyers around the country and ultimately globally who would file legal actions on their behalf to seek to protect and uphold their basic rights as citizens under the public trust doctrine and under constitutions.
And the focus being on children, and what was so important about that?
Well, that just kind of happened. I mean, when we first started talking about bringing these legal actions, we weren't really focused on bringing them on behalf of young people. But then I started talking to young people who were climate activists, and including Alec Lures, who had founded Kids Versus Global Warming. And there was just this incredible desire by young people to get involved and do something bigger to protect their legal rights. And now, today, 4 years later, we have young people emailing us and calling us and are just really anxious and excited to get involved. So it kind of just evolved that way, honestly. And young people have the most to lose. They're the generation alive today who will live the longest with the consequences of our failure to act on mm-hmm. their behalf. And they do represent the next generation, or the next seven generations, as Kelsey talked about.
Exactly. And Kelsey, you yourself, how did you first get involved? Actually, you're at a friend of mine's house right now, Elaine Weiss, and she was just telling me on the phone last night that she remembers you at 2 reciting the Lorax story, which is an environmental story. So you've been into this sort of thing for a long time?
That is too funny. Yeah, about that same age, I would say my first chant was, "Clear cluts are bad."
Clear cuts are bad.
Yeah, but I didn't understand, so I said cluts, clear cluts. So that caught on pretty fast. That's too funny. No, yeah, my parents, they fought for their own environmental justice back in the 1990s. And, they were protecting, they were trying to protect old growth forests in Oregon and surrounding areas in the Northwest. And so I guess I was kind of raised with basically ethics and morals focused around being environmentally conscious, being conscious about, your impact on other people, on other generations down the line. So I think I'm very blessed to have a family who this is just kind of part of our moral compass and basically the ethics I grew up, hearing and talking about within my family. And yeah, there was definitely a sense of like, oh, it's my turn. Like, this is my effort. Very much so, because, the forest that they try to protect from clear cutting and old growth logging is now endangered because of climate change,
right.
Due to severe intensity fires due to long, dry, hot summers, and et cetera, et cetera. So I guess that's kind of how I first became interested. It was not really something new. It was kind of always there. My parents have been talking about climate change in the 90s, and so this is definitely nothing new,
mm-hmm.
And it's only getting more severe and more scary, honestly. But specifically with our Children's Trust, they approached me when I was just graduated in eighth grade, going into high school, and there was some hesitancy. I remember my mom saying, I don't know if we should do this. It's a legal process. Who knows how long it could take? You could still be in college, and this thing could be going on. And at this time, yeah, like, it's definitely true. I could maybe be in grad school. Who knows? But it's definitely worth it. It's worth protecting constitutional rights. It's worth, making sure that I'm doing all I can to protect not only, resources in my time, but in my kids' and grandkids' time. So,
Julia, I read on your website that climate was an important issue for you when you became a mother. Was that the case?
Yeah, that's right. I had young children when I was pregnant, actually, when Katrina hit. And I think having babies and starting to raise children and thinking about the world that I'm going to leave them really made me question in my environmental law practice whether I was doing enough and using my skills to try to stop climate change. And so I had this desire to really do something more than the traditional environmental statutory law practice that I had. And today, in doing this work, I really think of myself as a human rights lawyer, because what we're doing ultimately is about protecting the planet for humans and other species as well. But the biggest threat right now is to, I think, our children and human civilization. So yeah, that was a big tipping point for me. Was, oh my gosh, what do I want to leave my children?
Right, right. And actually, the Pope right now is huge on this, talking about it as an issue of human rights as well as climate. They're all very intertwined. And the Paris conference will be happening in December. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of momentum now where people are beginning to realize that this is really affecting all of us hugely. I was going to ask you, Chris, like, what made you get involved in all of this?
So, yeah, thanks. So my organization, the Cragg Law Center, is a public interest environmental law firm. So we're basically set up as a nonprofit so that we can work and represent citizen activists and conservation groups on difficult cases that potentially have a very positive impact on the public good, but probably wouldn't get brought by private attorneys.
Right.
Risky cases, difficult cases, groundbreaking cases that pose difficult questions of law but are very, very important, as Julia says, for human rights and for, you know, our common resources. So I got involved in the work, one, because I cared very deeply about the issue of climate change and saw what it was doing to Oregon, what it was doing, what it was going to continue to do to our state. And I just really felt very passionately that our generation has an obligation, a responsibility, a moral duty to do something about this problem so that we don't pass on a legacy of failure to our kids and grandkids. And so, you know, when Julia approached me about the work, I was excited about it. I thought it was a way to put into action those values that I held very close. And also it was a very compelling legal argument. I think we're right. I think the public trust doctrine is absolutely essential, has been upheld for decades and decades. And it's a unique factual setting that we're dealing with right now. But fundamentally, I think it's absolutely right that the government has an obligation to uphold these natural resources for the public as beneficiaries.
Right, and especially as you're all saying, for our children, because they're going to be suffering the consequences, you know,
that's right.
Hugely.
That's right.
And then of course the grandchildren, and it just goes on and on. I wanted to just say again that you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. I'm speaking with Julia Olson, Executive Director of Our Children's Trust, Kelsey Juliana, who has a lawsuit going here in Oregon, with Chris Winter of the Cragg Law Center as her lawyer. And if you'd like to call in with your questions or comments, the phone number here is 503-231-8187. I was looking at the website again, and I saw these arguments kind of against it, against what you're trying to do. And I was going to sort of bring a few of those up to see how you could respond to them. One of them, a fellow named Richard Stewart, who was a professor of environmental law at New York University, he started off by saying that all of this was unprecedented. It's gone a long way beyond what any state court has tried to do before. And how would you argue with that? It seems like right off, maybe it's not so unprecedented.
Julia, do you want to take the first crack at that?
Sure. the funny thing is it's unprecedented perhaps in the last couple of decades, when cases that implicate our natural environment have largely been brought under statutory frameworks. So in the 70s, the late 60s and 70s, our Congress passed a bunch of laws to protect things like our water and our air and endangered species and so on. And state governments did a similar thing. And so a lot of the litigation and a lot of the legal work that has happened, and this whole legal community has grown up around those environmental statutes. But what people sometimes forget is the origins of those statutes were all about the public trust doctrine, and we're all about these fundamental rights that people hold. And the other thing that's worth pointing out is that those statutes have fundamentally failed us when it comes to climate change. I mean, those statutes have done some things and have protected certain resources in certain places, and I've used them, and I'm glad they've been there, but they have also resulted in vast degradation to natural systems. Because some of those agencies that enforce those laws and implement them are co-opted by industry.
Yeah.
And so I would say that while this is maybe unprecedented in the last couple of decades as a legal tool to protect our essential natural resources, it's actually a very ancient, long-standing tool that goes back to the founding of our nation. And so in that way, it's not unprecedented. It's grounded and rooted in our history and our traditions as a people.
Yeah, and it seems like it's something that it's very obvious when you just sort of look at it, you know, that yes, this, it's not just the water that matters, it's the air, as you were saying earlier. Another argument, though, that he said is that the atmosphere is global. And so, for instance, Oregon can by no means solve this problem, even in Oregon, because, you know, air from China is drifting over Oregon, or the air is just drifting all over the planet. And how can one state, you know, quote, take responsibility for that? Do you have an idea? Could you comment on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that that's a common refrain. And I just think, personally, to be frank, that's a defeatist attitude. And I think that that is an easy excuse to avoid moral responsibility for our own actions. Uh-huh. And so while it's certainly true that Oregon alone can't solve the problem, to say that we collectively can't solve the problem is just fundamentally wrong as a matter of science and a matter of fact. And I think it's morally wrong to say we can't solve the problem. We absolutely have to try to solve the problem. It's going to take a global effort. And in order for it to succeed, Oregon and Washington and California and every other state in the union is going to have to do its part and is going to have to be successful. And that is a fundamental obligation on our state governments to take effort, to show leadership, and to be successful in order to make sure that we pass on something we're proud of to the younger generation. And so to say that Oregon can't solve the problem alone is certainly not an excuse for absolving the state government of any responsibility
right.
to take action.
It's sort of like people saying, well, you know, I can drive hundreds and thousands of miles and burn, set my temperature super high.
That's
or
right.
whatever.
That's right.
Because it doesn't matter because I'm just one
That's
person.
That's right. And, you know, and courts, going back to this question of whether it's unprecedented or not, you know, throughout our history here in the United States, courts have always responded to new threats and new injustices that have come up. And it takes some time sometimes for that to happen. And I think the most recent Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage is a perfect example of
right.
that, is that once the courts really begin to understand the tremendous injustice that is occurring, the courts respond and respond in meaningful and important ways. And in that instance, you know, read a fundamental right into the Constitution that addressed the injustice of the oppression that was happening as a result of gay marriage. And I really firmly believe we're at a tipping point right now on climate change as well,
uh-huh.
where the courts are beginning to understand that they really have a very important and fundamental role to play in ensuring that our other branches of government are forced to take real leadership and ownership over this issue. And so
but,
I think
yeah.
we're going to start to see the courts play a more assertive role.
That sounds great. I mean, especially, yeah, because it's been so neglected by the politicians. We do have a caller. Joe, would you like to ask your question?
I don't have a question. I just have a comment,
sure.
which is basically, if we want to get, can you hear me okay, by the way?
Yeah, great.
Okay. If we really want to get to the root of this problem, we've got to stop reproducing as humans. The lady was just talking about earlier about her kids, you know, down the road when she has kids. People got to start thinking, hey, I don't want the responsibility of having kids. I don't want the extra pollution that's going to come along with having extra kids, because all those kids are going to have some place to live. And pollution is caused by building construction, by putting in roads, putting in all the necessary infrastructure, sewer, water, power, all that stuff. People cause pollution. We got to lower the amount of people coming in.
Well,
45 years ago when I got out of high school, I said, I'm not having any kids. And I didn't. I saw the poster on the wall in my instructor's history classroom office. And it said, we have met the enemy, and he is us. And it was a large poster of a baby, a black and white poster of a baby that was about 3 feet by 2 feet. And the baby had a rattle, you know, the photograph of a baby sitting there in his diaper,
right.
probably 9-month-old baby. And it said, we have met the enemy, and he is us. And that stuck into my little feeble brain back at that age. And I just said, hey, there's too much pollution. We don't know when the Ruskies are going to nuke us, the Soviets. And believe me, I know enough people that worked in behind the lines in the military And we went to the final stage before the president gave the final launch codes to launch the nukes.
Uh-huh.
At least four different times that I know of.
Okay, Joe, I want to let Chris respond.
We need less people. We need to put the mindset into young people. Hey,
no kids.
Don't have children unless, like the bumper sticker says, don't breed them if you can't feed them.
Okay, Joe, I have your point. I want to let Chris respond, okay?
So,
and all of those kids are feeding all of this CO2 and all this nonsense with all the coal plants being built in China.
Chris.
So Joe, first of all, let me just say thank you very much for your comment. I for the most part, agree with you. I think population is a huge issue. And I think a lot of people are calling on funding and a focus on women's health and empowerment, education, particularly in developing countries, to tackle that issue. And I think that's really the appropriate place to put the focus at this point. I think that's where the most benefits can be gained, and the most important justice issues are also to be found. And so I really think that population question is critical. And I think that the U.S. government in particular should be doing more to support those efforts at women's health education overseas in developing countries to tackle that problem.
Yeah. And I'd like to get back again then to some of these issues that were the complaints. I saw a Forbes magazine article where they just said the climate is just this nebulous entity and atmospheric carbon is a vague concept. Like, which sort of struck me as this is actually very real. You're talking about 350 parts per million. There's like real stuff going on. But are you running into that argument too, that it's just all too vague for us to be dealing with?
You know, we haven't run into that argument here in Oregon much. I think, as Julie mentioned earlier, what the state government has done here, and they haven't honestly shown a lot of leadership around climate here in Oregon, but what the state government has done is it's admitted to the science of climate change. So our state government admits that it's human caused. The state government admits that we're going to see catastrophic impacts on our natural resources here in Oregon. And those are very concrete things, climate science. But what the state government hasn't done is to show any leadership around what we need to do to fix the problem.
Right. And as it even says, it's not meeting its own goals.
That's right. That's right.
And Julianne, I have another argument that I came up with for you, that it says the youth are too young to really be knowing what you're doing. It's as if you're brainwashed. How would you argue with that one?
Right. So that's an excellent question. And also to address the previous question, I just want to state that my mom remembers back in her day when she was fighting for her justice efforts, you know, the feeling of terror, like, oh gosh, you know, we're going downhill, we're losing all of our old growth forests, the trees that give us life, that produce oxygen, that sequester the carbon that we are oh too rapidly and too fiercely producing. And so there's that fear in her time, you know, is it ethical to have children? Is that being good to the earth and to society? And the fact is, you know, those questions have been going through people's minds, I think, forever. There's been environmental degradation and environmental injustice for as long as we've been on this earth. And it is a scary idea, but it is a constitutional right to be able to breathe. It's a constitutional right to be able to have a family, provide for that family, to have access to clean water, to clean air. And I think it should be noted that yes, that is something that future generations, or I guess rather the younger generations, should be conscious of. It's also not their responsibility. It is the responsibility of those who are currently living and who are currently consuming and reproducing, goods and extracting energy, to be conscious of how much we are taking from this planet and how those are, eventually turn into consequences for the younger generations and for generations down the line. So really it is the responsibility of those currently living and especially currently in power and making those decisions around energy and natural resources.
The adults and especially the people in charge. Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so do you still want me to answer your second question about why?
Are you a brainwashed young kid?
I've heard this all the time, like, oh, this is just your parent, you know, your parents are setting you up for this. They're feeding you this information. And I think that is extremely offensive and also just really very denialist and very shutting down what you don't want to hear. If I hear that from someone, it's clear that they're too afraid of the truth and they don't want to face the fact that younger people are aware of their current situation more so than themselves, and that we're willing to look at the evidence, look at the facts, look at the science, address the critical state we're in, and advocate for ourselves. And that is a little intimidating, I'm sure, but the fact is youth are smart, youth are strong, youth are empowered. All we have to do is allow ourselves to be reminded of that and to hear their voices, because youth have so much to see and so much to say about the state that we're in, and it's a good reminder that we are the upcoming leaders of this of society, as far as, you know, places of power and in government branches, but also we are the leaders of our own generation, no matter what age we are at, because we have the most up-to-date, most upfront look at the place that we're in and the place that we're headed.
Right, and you can't vote, so in a certain way, this going to the courts is like perhaps the best, you know, most reasonable way to deal with it, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And one last little point about that was an objection to it was that, oh, well, the state's environmental protection agencies are responsible for protecting the environment. And you know, it should just be something that they deal with. It shouldn't be something that the courts get involved with. Julia, could you respond to that one?
Sure. So I want to go back to the Obergefell versus Hodges case, the recent marriage equality decision, where Justice Kennedy, who tends to be more of a conservative on the court, but he wrote the opinion, and he said that the nation's courts are open to injured individuals who come to them to vindicate their own direct personal stake in our Constitution, mm-hmm. and that individuals need not await legislative action, executive action, before asserting a fundamental right. And we get this all the time where people will say, well, isn't this just a job of the legislature or the executive or a particular agency? And the answer is no, because we live in a constitutional democracy. We don't live in a pure democracy where majority rules. We live in a constitutional democracy where fundamental rights must be protected and our courts must act as a check on the other two branches of government. And that way, people who are in the minority, like children, or like gay people who want to marry, or even future generations, I would argue, are a minority. At this point, they have no political power. They don't have the right to vote. Those interests still get protected in our system. And it's really, really important, especially in our system today, which really favors moneyed interests, because we don't have campaign finance reform and because there's so much investment in elections by special interest groups, including the fossil fuel industry.
Right. So it sounds like basically, I love this, that the people who don't have power still have a say in things. They still have rights is basically where you're taking this argument.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then if you think about it in terms of like the state environmental protection agencies are responsible. So in Washington State, I want to go back to that just a little bit. That was the Department of Ecology, right?
That's correct.
And what are you actually asking them to do now? What are you saying that they absolutely must do?
We're asking them to basically set the emission reduction targets that the state of Washington is responsible for in order to be on that 350 trajectory that we talked about earlier. So they need to look at what is our carbon budget until 2050.
For the state of Washington, specifically.
The state of Washington's carbon uh-huh. budget. And then what should our annual emission reductions look like in order to meet that carbon budget so that we're not expending more of our entitlement to carbon than we should be. So in part, it's setting those numbers and doing the math to match up with the science. And then it's also taking the next step of figuring out the implementation plan.
Yeah.
And in Washington State, the Department of Ecology is charged with that task. It is absolutely their job. And again, they don't deny or dispute the science either. They've just said, we don't have to do it right now.
They wanted to delay it, actually, until apparently this Paris conference, it sounded like. I want to get back to that a little more, but I want to let listeners know you're listening to The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland, and we're talking about young people taking climate change fight to the courts. It's with an organization called Our Children's Trust. I'm speaking with their executive director, Julia Olson, and Kelsey Juliana, who has a lawsuit going here in Oregon. Chris Winner of the Craig Law Center is her attorney, the attorney working with Kelsey. He's here with me in the studio. You can call in with your questions and comments. The number is 503-231-8187. I'm wondering about, it's interesting going back to what's going on or what is being demanded of Washington State. I mean, actually implementing this stuff sounds like it could be huge. For instance, would it affect permits for liquid natural gas terminals or the oil trains running through Washington? I mean, what kind of implementations, what kind of changes would actually be having to take place? Or is there a concept of that?
I think that there are a lot of concepts of that within these agencies, within government. I think they actually know what they would need to do on a kind of a sector-by-sector basis to achieve the emission reductions that they need. And, you know, government has known about this problem since the 1960s, at least, and actually in the 1990s, the federal government started developing plans for reducing emissions. And I know the state of Washington, under Governor Inslee's leadership, has been doing a lot of work to figure out what they need to do. And so it's basically a combination of regulatory mechanisms and also incentives, and carbon pricing is going to be a really big component, I think, of any ultimate emission reduction plan that's achievable. And that there needs to be leadership sort of looking at the big picture. If we do all of these things, will the math add up and will we achieve the emission reductions that we need?
And, you know, I just wanted to add in that here in Oregon, a lot of this work has already been done. So under the leadership of the Kulongoski administration, Oregon implemented greenhouse gas emission reduction targets, not binding requirements, but targets. But then also the Global Warming Commission, which was formed under Governor Kulongoski's leadership, developed a very detailed action plan for how to achieve those necessary greenhouse gas reductions.
Uh-huh.
Put that down on paper. We can all go and read it. And it has a very specific prescription for what must happen. But the problem here in Oregon is twofold. One, I think, is that was just an initial set of targets. But since that time, under the next two administrations, we've really seen a failure of leadership. Nobody has stepped up and said, we have to make this a reality. And so we know what needs to get done. It's on paper. It's doable. But we really haven't seen since that time any political will to actually make it happen. And that is because our political system is just fundamentally incapable of responding to this significant of a threat. It has to happen. But because of structural problems in our political system, there's certain interests that are standing in the way of making it actually happen on the ground.
As Julia said, they're like moneyed interests, basically.
That's right. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people share the concern that our legislative system, both at the federal level, but also here in Oregon, is really captured by special interests and is incapable of implementing the fundamental change that needs to take place. And so that's, I think, why the courts are really so important in making sure that we're successful in this effort.
Yeah, and the courts could actually push it through. And when you looked at those, the program that Kulongoski had set out, did it seem like it was going to trash our economy? Is this the kind of thing that they're afraid of?
It's absolutely not going to trash our economy. And actually, since that time, Portland State University and other scholars around the state and around the country have looked at what would happen to the economy if we made the fundamental changes that we need to make. And while there would be a reorganization of the economy, in fact, what they found is that it would either be neutral or beneficial for our state economy to make the changes that are going to be necessary. And so, although it might be scary for folks to think about a reorganization of the economy, once people really start to understand what it looks like, it's just there's a tremendous amount of opportunity for growth and a tremendous amount of opportunity for appreciating the solutions, clean energy, public transportation, reforestation. So those kinds of things that would not only make a difference on climate, but would also improve the health and resiliency of our communities.
Right. I mean, part of this, yeah, it would just make the world more beautiful, which is, you know.
Make the world more beautiful, create jobs, give the youth of tomorrow something to look forward to, and give them, honestly, a career path right. on a lot of really important industries.
Uh-huh. Sort of like moving out of the horse and buggy into cars. Now we're moving out of cars and into mass transit and renewable energy. And,
that's right.
And stuff that can make money in different ways.
That's right.
Yeah. Do you think that this sort of thing is going to end up going, these lawsuits, are they going to keep being appealed maybe all the way to the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it's a possibility that our lawsuit here in Oregon could end up in the Oregon Supreme Court. We're headed to the Oregon Court of Appeals next. That's an intermediate step between where we are now and the Oregon Supreme Court. That's certainly a possibility. I'm Julie can talk about other federal lawsuits that might come up in the future, and there's always the possibility that one of those could make their way up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And Julie, there was a federal lawsuit. Maybe you could tell us about that one.
Sure. There was a federal public trust case brought on behalf of youth and filed against several agencies of the federal government. Ultimately, it was dismissed by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. They found that there was no federal public trust obligation based on a complete misapplication of one Supreme Court decision. And we petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to review that decision, and they denied review, which wasn't unanticipated. They review only about 1% of the cases they're asked to take. So we are working on a new case, and we'll have more information to share about that in the next several weeks. But it will be a case filed by young people against the federal government. I would hope at some point that we won't have to keep appealing all of these cases, because the time is just so incredibly short to act. And I wanted to mention that Dr. James Hansen just this week announced the findings of a new paper that is being published this week, I believe, where they have concluded that because of the melting glaciers on Greenland and Antarctica, that the melting patterns that are happening are not linear as other scientists previously had projected, and they're anticipating that they will melt 10 times faster than previous estimates. And that means that we could have sea level rise of 10 feet in as little as 50 years.
Yeah. Yeah, and I heard it's even, it already is happening faster than they had thought it was happening. And he's saying it's happening even faster.
Even faster, 10 times faster because of the non-linear melting that is occurring. There's all this warm ocean water underneath these ice sheets, and it's causing very massive and quick disintegration. And, you know, 10 feet in sea level rise means Puget Sound and the communities around that sound are in trouble. Miami is gone. You know, Washington, D.C. and New York City and Boston, I mean, there are places that will be underwater.
Including many of our coastal communities here in Oregon.
Right. Tremendous displacement. It really comes back to, it sounds like, that we need to change our ways. There was a student, I don't know his first name, I can't pronounce it, but his name was Martinez, and he's the youth director of the Earth Guardians and has a lawsuit that his quote was, "It's about understanding, seeing that the way we're interacting with the world is destroying the planet. We see the earth as something we can use, something we can take from, cut down the last forest, fish the last big fish in the ocean. There's a disconnect between the problem and the cause because we don't want to admit to ourselves that we've created this catastrophe. To make that connection is tough. That's asking people to change the way they think, which is tougher than asking people to change their light bulbs." He's part of your part of our Children's Trust. Zwextatil Martinez?
Shutaska Martinez. He's the youth director of Earth Guardians. And Kelsey actually is on the RISE Youth Council with Shutaska. She works closely with him. And he is a part of all of this work. He has a case going in Colorado right now.
Right. And I like his notion that we need to change the way we think. We need to really almost just change our consciousness about what this planet is for and what we're doing here. Could you just comment on that a little?
Kelsey, do you want to take that one?
Absolutely. I just adore Shutaska, and I think that what he says is exactly what we need to implement into our lifestyle, and it's true. The time for simply recycling and turning off lights is so, so far in the past. It should be routine right now. We shouldn't even have to think of that and pat ourselves on the shoulder. That should be obvious that that is the lifestyle we need to be long already implementing. And so it's true. We need to switch the way we think. We need to switch the way we think about relationships with each other, with relationships with the earth, because, you know, as we talk about youth and the importance of youth being, you know, on these legal efforts and taking action and being empowered, really, you know, teaching youth about our environment is critical, but also just exposing them to the environment is critical, because if you love something and if you call something home, you're going to, you know, feel compelled to protect it and to keep loving it and to make sure that it lasts. And so I think Chatez Scott's point really hits on that. If we love our forests, if we love our coastlines, then we're going to do what we can to protect it so that, you know, we may have access and enjoy it, and that people we love, our children, generations down the line, may also have access to that. And that does come from a switch in consciousness, a switch in our thinking and the relationship we have to these natural places, and just exposing ourselves to what we truly love and to what we need.
And loving our mama Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah. And grassroots activism, climate activism, definitely has a role in all this as well, wouldn't you say? Just mm-hmm. to help the courts, sort of the way, you know, the movement changed with gay rights and civil rights and all of this. Seems like climate change activism could help the courts, you know, move them along.
I think that's absolutely right. I think the movement is critical. And what I would ask the movement to do for those out there who feel part of it, and hopefully all of your listeners do, is, you know, connect the movement in the streets to the constitutional rights and public trust rights movement in the courts, because that's what they did in the civil rights movement. When young people were marching, when they were sitting at lunch counters protesting, when they were riding buses protesting, they were exercising their constitutional rights and making sacrifices to protect them, and they were also articulating, we have a constitutional right to be here. We have a right to equality and to be treated the same as everybody else. And so I think we need to get that language out there more, that this is about our fundamental rights. This is about our democracy and the survivability of our country, as our nation and of people. So, yeah, I think connecting the movement with the very critical role of the courts is important.
Yeah, we have a right to a stable climate is basically what you're saying.
We do.
Yeah. And just a little bit more about our children's trust. Your website is ourchildrenstrust.org, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff about getting informed. You have something like a book out called Fish Tank that you were trying to get people to read or learn about.
Yeah, one of our partners wrote that book. It's a great book for kids, but adults alike. And I would like to say there are a lot of ways people can get involved. I mean, one thing that's very simple, hopefully, that some people can do is to go to the Crag Law Center website, crag.org or ourchildrenstrust.org, and make a donation, sign up to be on our list so that you can receive information. There will be opportunities to support Kelsey in the lawsuit coming up as the briefing gets going before the Court of Appeals here in Oregon. There are also ways to get involved at the local level through Our Children's Trust and with some other state work that's exciting that's coming up. So I really encourage people to get involved. And I also want to say that our Children's Trust, could not do this work without people like Chris Winter and the Crag Law Center, who donate time and act on a pro bono basis to represent young people.
Lawyers are basically working pro bono.
They are, and we could not do that without them. So for all you Portlanders up there, support the Crag Law Center. They're great.
Okay. A real quick little notice that somebody brought in was that growing industrial hemp would use up carbon in the atmosphere. It uses more carbon than many other industrial grown crops. So that's maybe something to add to this. And we've just legalized the growing of pot in Oregon, so maybe that can help. And then there's a lot of science sources for people to get involved if they want to know more, and that those are on your websites as well, right?
Okay.
And basically, do you? I just to finish up real quick. One, well, maybe we're running out of time actually, but I just wanted to know if you guys are feeling pretty hopeful. Just sort of quick yes or no.
So I feel very hopeful. I'm really excited to go to the Court of Appeals and present these issues to a panel of three judges here in Oregon. I think that's going to be a very exciting time for Kelsey and our Children's Trust and us as well. So that's going to be a really great process.
Okay, well, I really want to thank all three of you for being on the radio with us. Just to let you know, today's guests have been Julia Olson, Executive Director of our Children's Trust, Kelsey Juliana, who has a lawsuit going here in Oregon to stabilize our climate. Chris Winter is of the Craig Law Center, is an attorney working with Kelsey. He's here with me in the studio. And this is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and I want to thank Tammy for her engineering, and thank you for listening.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, July 20th, 2015. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, in spite of the number of new cab companies entering Portland, it hasn't discouraged one more competitor. Echo Cab, featuring whisper quiet, all-electric, luxury Tesla sports sedans, is entering the fray. A ride in a Tesla Model S, widely considered the best automobile on the road, will cost a little more, but might be worth it.
While a recent state report shows Portland gained 2,000 jobs last month, the unemployment rate continued to edge up. Stores and restaurants added many of the new jobs, while about